Let's return to This Week in America. Here's your host, Rick Bratton.
Welcome back, everybody. Coast to coast, This Week in America. Daryl Nathaniel Bridgers, a trailblazing African-American attorney, celebrated screenwriter, and visionary creative force, has unveiled his first full-length novel, Ripple of Hope, from the Boiling Frog's perspective. This debut work is a powerful fictionalization of Bridgers' profound and deeply personal battle against racism in New York City. Blending his experience as a legal professional with his storytelling prowess, Daryl crafts a narrative that is moving and transformative. Attorney, actor, director, musician, and author of Ripple of Hope from the Boiling Frog's perspective, Daryl Nathaniel Bridgers, our guest on This Week in America. Daryl, welcome to the program. A pleasure to have you with us.
Thank you so much, Rick. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
What a remarkable book this is. What a remarkable career you're having. We'll talk about all the other aspects that you're involved in. Talking about the book, Ripple of Hope, from the Boiling Frog's perspective, you learned at an early age the legal system was not necessarily fair. Share a little bit, if you will, about that. And then how did that shape the foundation for the book, if it did?
Sure. I grew up, you know, not in I would say more than a modest financial situation. And when I grew up, one of the things I wanted to do is kind of give back to the community. So my first career was actually teaching. And I was, you know, elementary school teacher in California. And a lot of the students from lower economic classes, you know, whether they had issues, you know, personally, et cetera, you know, I found the advocacy on their behalf, both as a teacher and later, you know, working with, you know resources like social services and dealing with attorneys. I found that families, a lot of people didn't have access to the same resources from a legal perspective as their richer neighbors, et cetera. And so I wanted to make sure that, you know, when I became an attorney, that I was able to continue on that type of work, because I think it's very important. I think the American legal system is great in its conception, but I do think it has its limitations, mostly related to financial circumstances. So.
It's an interesting journey you were on, and you'll read the fictionalization of this, and on the website, it's his name, so remember that, and I'll give it to you, spelling, and as we go through the program, DarylNathanielBridgers.com. Links on our website, thisweekinamerica.us. You went into law initially as an effort to protect yourself and your family. Then, as you say, you gravitated towards advocacy, work, equity, equality. What's that transition been like for you? What's it like transitioning to where you are now in law practice?
Yeah, so professionally, I work for a major corporation, but I've also tried to do both pro bono throughout my entire career, working with organizations such as A Better Chance to help students. As I started my legal career, I wanted to make sure that I did pro bono and continue to work, you know, both the child advocacy initiatives and education. One of my most proud initiatives was working with Head Start, a program that was both in the Bronx and other parts of New York City. So, you know, it's always been a passion of mine. Currently, I work in the corporate environment, but I didn't want to make sure, I wanted to make sure that whatever training I had professionally, I was also able to translate that into some of my more philanthropic endeavors, if you will.
The basis for the storyline in Ripple of Hope from the Boiling Frog's perspective is resilience and determination. How would you describe the main character in the story?
Well, the main character is Kai Jones, which is based predominantly on my personal story with litigation. And going back to the topic of not having access to the same type of legal services, I find myself in a battle with a corporation of sorts that had an attorney that was, you know, paid by an insurance company. And I've quickly found out that it was almost impossible for me to kind of continue the effort of defending myself and my family without the same types of resources. So I actually decided to go pro se, which means that you represent yourself. But litigation, as all crafts, is not transparent. And there's a lot of pitfalls that you can fall into if you don't know the nuances of the different rules and of the court, etc. And so my initial thing I started to do was to write a self-help guide for people that were in similar situations. I also wanted my daughters, my two children, to understand that regardless of your circumstances, if you need to defend yourself, you know, we have access to systems that help do that. And I wanted them to learn at an early age that they didn't just have to take abuse because, you know, other people were giving it to them. They can actually react to it and defend themselves. So it was kind of a two-pronged approach, both the family, nuclear family, if you will, to make give them an example, but also the broader community that we live in to help them as well.
You said something there interesting about nuances. Do the various courtrooms and courthouses have either nuances between those, a little, maybe a different personality between courtrooms?
Well, there's civil procedure, obviously, that, you know, everyone is subject to universally. You know, different states have different laws, but they're loosely the same. Back when I was doing this litigation, it was a heavy paper-driven environment. So you had to understand, like, when you did litigation, if you wanted to appeal, how much those paper documents that you provided that were given to you needed to be reproduced in the civil litigation. You know, also, obviously, I think courts have different, you know, they obviously have different judges. The rules are largely the same, but, you know, personalities do come into play as well. So
our guest is Daryl Nathaniel Bridgers. The book we're talking about is A Ripple of Hope from the Boiling Frog's Perspective. Let's break down the boiling frog metaphor, if you will. Talk to us about some of the dangers of oppression that slowly creeps in, sometimes not even noticed.
Yeah, the metaphor of the boiling frog has been used many times, sometimes in films here and there. Basically, it's the idea that if you are placed into tepid water and it is brought slowly to a boil, you won't notice it until it's too late, and then when you try to get out, you die, basically. So the question is, as the water, but if you put that same frog into a boiling pot, it'll try to get out immediately. I think, you know, in our society, we find ourselves a lot of times in a situation that may be uncomfortable a little bit, but not too uncomfortable that you can still bear it. But over time, it becomes hot, and you don't want to wait too long when it becomes too hot, and then you don't have any resources or energy to actually get out of it. So that is really the idea behind it. Whatever the situation is, personal or business-wise, I think we owe it to ourselves to kind of look and be introspective. If we feel something that is not quite comfortable for our skin, or we don't, you know, quite agree with, that we actually do take the time, evaluate, and speak up if necessary.
Things can get out of control rapidly, can't they, once they start going in the right in the wrong direction?
Yeah, they can go left, and you know, and there's times when I looked back at some of the story, I thought I could have made one decision and maybe would have gone a different way. And I won't give away any spoilers in the book, but there's one episode in particular where I could have made a decision, but I decided to continue on with the litigation, mostly to protect my family, but it went way left. And it took on a even more, you know, incredible time and you know, emotional presence in my life negatively that I did not expect, anticipate, or even want. But I'm still here today, so that, you know, the spoiler is I got through it. And I'm hopefully it will inspire others to get through it as well.
And Daryl's with us today, and he's okay. So he did make it through that that episode in the book. The duality of courage and vulnerability, how do they relate and coincide with one another? Because those are key elements in your book, in your life.
I think a lot of times when people are victims of whatever the situation, in order to kind of speak up or speak out against it, and to protect yourselves, you know, it means opening up to others and publicly exposing yourself to, whether it's ridicule, criticism, or even opposition to, you know, what you're going through. And that's a vulnerable place to be, especially if you feel like you've been hurt. You know, many people don't want to risk going outside of their comfort zone to actually defend themselves. And sometimes you do stand that type of water that is slowly being brought to a boil. So the idea behind this is really, for me personally, is to expose and to be vulnerable to the larger community out there, to show people that it actually is possible to have courage, but also be afraid at the same time. And that's okay. It's a part of our fight or flight syndrome, or, you know, psyche. You know, we try to protect ourselves by either fleeing or fighting. But sometimes when you fight, you know, that's not, you know, I'm no Superman. And it does require, you know, a little bit of getting used to some of the pain and adversity, and again, vulnerability that you're exposing yourself to people that, you know, you normally would not, in order to either improve your situation or for the greater good of other people.
How long has this project been in the making? And I'm thinking as we're talking, is this something that's building, has been building subconsciously even for years to leading up to this story and this fictionalization, the story that you tell?
Great question. Thank you for asking that. The litigation itself that that this book is primarily centered around took 7 years. And then, you know, after the period, I found myself very angry once the litigation was over. And, you know, it was kind of a catharsis to be able to, a cathartic experience to be able to write about it and really open the emotions and explore that. Although the initial, you know, reason behind the book is I wanted to, there's a lot of pitfalls. And I made, you know, some almost fatal mistakes in the litigation. I wanted to kind of create a map for people who wanted to also be pro se to show them what the pitfalls are and the different rules to either comply with or avoid in certain situations. The original book idea was to create a kind of a really just a pamphlet of like how to do pro se. I thought it was a little bit, you know, not interesting, frankly. And so I tried to create some anecdotes behind each step of the process, and then it just ballooned into a much larger story. And I was actually surprised with the outcome. The story, I think, is good. But, you know, beyond that, it was helpful to me to be able to see it in writing, to actually put it out there so that in a very proactive and way that was constructive versus destructive. So that's what I got out of the experience myself.
The book creates an opportunity for self-reflection, healing, growth for Kai Jones in the book. What indirect effect or experience do you think that will create for the reader? What do you hope the reader takes as we're studying and seeing Kai go through all of these emotions?
I hope the readers will come away with, I can identify with that character. That was me too. And I felt whether victimized or stupid, or I could have done something differently. And this person actually, you know, was doing just living his life, and things happened outside of his control. And, you know, even though it was painful and he had to deal with work and the responsibilities of the family, he was able to actually also focus on this type of issue in his life. One review that I got, if I can paraphrase it a little bit.
Yes.
On Goodreads, that I love it. When I first read it, I was like, where is this person going? As I continue to read it, kind of reflects, again, what I'm just talking about. It says, this book was excruciating to read. And I says, oh, no.
Yeah, what a start,
Right. But then the person was, they continued, this is too close to home. It was almost like a horror film where I felt like I wanted to say, don't do it. But the character does it. And, you know, with the consequences that were evident as a reader. And so from that, I took that the person that read the book, you know, very much identified with the character and wanted to give Kai advice as to what not to do because they actually live that same or similar issues in their life. And so I really love that review because it kind of encapsulates what I want people to feel like, almost like, you know, anticipating things that are going to happen, but also identifying with it and kind of interacting with it on a very personal level.
It's great when you bring up. Go ahead, Fanny. I'm sorry.
But also, you know, the title itself, Ripple of Hope. This is just one story and many stories out there. And I hope that this little ripple of hope can help other people, get through their situations, whatever it may be.
It's nice when you draw a reader in like that, intellectually and emotionally as well, that gets caught up in the story. And it sounds like it did him some good and starting to, you know, relate to the situation and what he is going through or possibly going through. What were some of the challenging parts of crafting and telling Kai's story? What challenged you? What were the difficult times to write?
The emotional, you know, because it was a personal story, and I changed all the names to avoid any future litigation, just FYI. but it was a deeply personal story and emotional. And as I was writing it, you know, having to relive some of those episodes, it was very painful. And so, you know, in those moments where I felt like, you know, I couldn't be objective, I actually had to put the book aside a little bit. And so, you know, between that and my professional obligations as a lawyer where I currently work, it took about 7 years to get through. And so, you know, in addition to the 7 years of the actual story, You know, so at, there were certain points because of the length of time that had passed where I just wanted to give up and just like not, you know, do it anymore, frankly. But every time I tried to put it down, it kept calling me back. And I thought, you know, this is a story that needs to be told. Somebody, even if it's one person that needs to hear it and get a little bit of hope, that continued to encourage me. And so, you know, I'm happy with the outcome. I'm happy that I was able to stick through it. You know, had I known both in the litigation or in the writing how long it would have taken and kind of the process I would have went through, I may not have done it. But you kind of learn as you go along, and I'm happy that it came out the way it did.
The book we're talking about is Ripple of Hope from the Boiling Frog's Perspective. It's written by our guest on the program today, Daryl Nathaniel Bridgers. Book is available wherever books are sold. His website is very simple. His name, DarylNathanielBridgers.com. We've got a link for that on our website, thisweekinamerica.us. You can link on, get information on Daryl, and order the book there as well. You've taken on this multidimensional approach to storytelling. How do you determine what you feel and what will resonate with the audience? What's that process like of trying to figure out what's going to really emotionally connect with the audience?
Initially, I was writing for catharsis and trying to, like, you know, get through and make sense of a period in my life that I thought was very painful. And as I was writing it, that was in to actually have a record for my children in the future to look at if they ever come across similar situations. And one of the things that I, you know, some of it was, you know, frankly, this is a much more condensed version of the book that I originally, you know, penned for the first manuscript. I had a bunch of, I guess you call them, readers to kind of look at it from different walks of life, just to kind of spot check and give me a sense of how they felt reading the book. And from their input, I actually, you know, I was able to kind of step away a little bit and take some objective remarks and constructive criticism of how to make it more user-friendly, if you will, and less about kind of me and more about the reader's experience.
The reading experience that comes from this book seems all-encompassing. It covers the ability to wrestle with external injustice, internal weaknesses. Speaking to universal truths about perseverance and the human spirit, why is this important to talk about at this particular time?
Well, you know, our nation is in a bit of influx. A friend of mine recently sent me, a video, maybe it's on Instagram, from two politicians from different, you know, different sides of the aisles that were saying, you know, it really touched me that their friends in person, you know, in their interpersonal contact, but on this, you know, even in the political stage, they, you know, they disagree vehemently on a lot of issues, but they're able to come together and really understand each other. And I think that's what people are lacking a lot. You know, if something has happened in somebody's life, you know, the knee-jerk reaction is, well, that's them. It shouldn't happen to me because I believe in this, or this is the things I endorse. And I think at the end of the day, we're all human. We all, you know, have needs, and we all have the basic, you know, things that we want for our families and our children. And I think this is kind of a coming-of-age story for, you know, people of my generation, you know, mid to late 50s. And I think people, whatever their walk of life, whether they're, you know, African-American, whether they're male or female or et cetera, it's something that I think should resonate and actually bring people together. And I think a story with human aspects that kind of touch upon those themes, I do think that's unifying. And I hope it will kind of resonate with people in the sense that, you know, larger, it's larger than just one person. It's larger than just the African-American community. Although it's largely centered on that in the story, I encourage people to read it all the way to the last page. There's a lot of footnotes for references I make, but at the very end, I have a bunch of credits that starts with Reuben Carter, just the names of people from 1966 all the way through a name, Mario Gonzalez, 2021. You can kind of review those stories and everything in between. There's a lot of, you know, these can just be names on the page, but I want them to be more three-dimensional. Because it doesn't matter. I don't know any of these people, you know, different walks of life, et cetera. But they have one thing in common. You know, they were victims in certain circumstances. They were able to fight back. Some cases they weren't able to fight back. But it's just to remember that, you know, we're not just one-dimensional names on a page. We actually have people that are affected by, you know, how we live and how we're, you know, how we're impacted. So if I have a negative day or somebody, you know, treats me badly, you know, what am I going to do? Am I going to, like, translate that into how I deal with other people, even family members. And so if I get hurt, you're not just hurting the one person, you're hurting everybody, you know, around and behind me. And vice versa, if you're doing good to people, you're also doing good to people around or behind them. So I want to make sure that, you know, people kind of walk away that this is a universal application and that we actually have a lot in common regardless of our walk of life. Again, I'm hoping that people will identify with that and see that, and that's coming in this, initial book.
In your career in this book, you talk a lot about realizations, a journey shaped by realizations. Talk about that. What you mean by realizations and how they play a role in our decision making?
Yeah, you grow up, you know, and at least I grew up in a sense, you know, you're this cute kid, and then and you may have, you know, good academic credentials, and then all of a sudden you're this adult with these responsibilities, and you realize, you know, people don't look at you the same way as you see yourself. Even like hearing, if you think about how you hear yourself when you listen to yourself on a recording, you may not like it. You know, you may love yourself or really like yourself, but not everybody likes you or love how you
yes.
present yourself. And so the realization that, you know, how do people perceive me? How am I, you know, different from the persona that I think I'm projecting? You know, those types of realizations really come to the foreway when you come to situations that are traumatic. And you really learn a lot about a person's character when they have traumatic situations, whether it's financial issues, health issues, et cetera. You know, I hope that, you know, this character Kai can show that, you know, not everyone's perfect. Everyone has flaws. And Kai obviously doesn't, I hope, you know, he doesn't come across as the hero of the story that does everything perfectly. Because we're all flawed, but I do think
yes.
we all deserve, you know, some grace in that. And it was a realization of the flawed character in myself and Kai, and the idea of actually needing and wanting grace from other people to be able to continue to, you know, to progress and to do things that, you know, are as good for yourself and your family.
All through your life, you've been championing diversity and inclusivity. Talk about where we are with that now, because some people will say that's not even constitutional to do that. I don't know where we're going as a country, but things that I thought we were building on in a positive way seem to be getting torn down. When you hear about this, you know, DEI, and you can't do that anymore, and you're involved in the corporate world as well, what are your thoughts on where we are and where possibly we're going?
Yeah, unfortunately, diversity is turned into a four-letter word, if you will, for
yes.
some spaces, you know, and I think it's important to understand why that is in certain communities. But I do think that when you come to any kind of situation with a different background, different way to think about things, I think that just, you know, enriches the entire conversation or the entire experience. I mean, this country was founded,
yes.
you know, by people from different communities outside of America. You know, there's the, you know, the negative history associated with that. And there's also the positive history. But I think if you look at, you know, what America was traditionally, you know, deemed to be, it was a melting pot of cultures, of languages, of economic backgrounds. And I think that's what makes this place such a rich place to live and grow up in. Obviously, we have issues to deal with. But, you know, to walk away or to shy away from the idea of diversity in the name of, you know, a greater good, whatever you believe that is, I think, you know, that's a little bit flawed, because I think, again, what makes this place great is the differences and points of view and the idea of being able to speak freely and to be able to collaborate and dispute in a way that our founding fathers, I think personally, and there's a great book on that, how they, you know, lived and worked, you know, together, even if they were, you know, vehemently opposed to the, you know, politically, they were still able to found a country based on ideas that were universal in its application. I hope people don't forget that, you know, this is, you know, if you're a citizen, you know, this was for everyone and not just for a select few, as I've heard recently in some academic circles, which I absolutely don't believe in. I do believe that this is a place, you know, that is not monocultural for a reason, and it's better because of it.
How hopeful are you for the future? Again, I come back to, I thought we'd made some progress and things that we were building on seemed to be in jeopardy of being taken apart. Are you optimistic at all about where we're going and how we're going to get there?
Yeah, it is tricky. You know, I try to always be, you know, glass half full versus glass half empty. And, you know, I think it takes going back to the concept of having courage, but also being willing to be vulnerable, because, you know, people are not going to agree with this interview maybe. And they some people will say negative things. That's to be expected. But as long as it's with a view to understand each other. So I'm hopeful that people are, you know, intelligent enough or open enough to be able to disagree or agree to disagree, if you will, and to be able to have a real conversation. So I'm hopeful for that. You know, I came up, you know, I was born in the 60s, where there's a lot of turmoil still, you know, coming out of turmoil in the American community. And some may say we're kind of circling back to that. But I do think there's enough voices out there, resilient people that can, you know, step up and have been stepping up. And I'm very hopeful for the things I've seen out there when people seem not to be listening to each other, that there is a you know, whether you think it's small or significant, there is a number of voices out there that are, you know, endorsing that and being courageous and being vulnerable, whether you're on, you know, left or the right, to actually come together and to, you know, make this a better place, if you will. You know, and that might sound like pie in the sky or I'm being political, but I'm really hoping that, you know, even in this trauma that I've dealt with and where I was very angry, that people will come away with the sense of, okay, I can deal with injustice, but I can also deal injustice and tell people that have different backgrounds from me.
With us on the program is Daryl Nathaniel Bridgers. We've got just a couple minutes left. I want to touch on the corporate career, the Citigroup, Global Markets. I read that you guide a team and you've got an innovative approach with Tea Time. Talk about what is Tea Time?
Well, yeah, so that goes again to diversity. I spent some time in Scotland and in England, and, you know, they have these periodic breaks during the day where they have tea and they're able to talk together. And so, you know, I have a team that I lead that, you know, I try to get professional advice and very programmatic ways to help them, you know, progress their careers. A lot of that is on the record in the guise of semi-annual and annual reviews, but I also try to take it, you know, a more personal level. I've called it Tea Time. Basically, I have an off the record conversation and just really to have a tea to kind of hear back from them, and versus me always imposing on them, you know, kind of where I think the team should be going. I want to hear from them, you know, and get some really constructive feedback. And I don't have an agenda for the tea times. We just schedule a tea, and sometimes they schedule with me with no real agenda, like, as I said. But when I see tea time on my calendar, I know this is going to be a different conversation. So I go in, you know, courageous and vulnerable and really hearing, you know, what I'm doing well, what I'm not doing well, what can be improved, you know, what they're looking for, what things they would like to get out of their daily experience or their long-term career goals. So I think that's something that I endorse. I hope more people would do that. And again, it's a non-threatening way to help people open up, to be able to, again, be a little bit vulnerable in low-risk situations. It's always confidential. Or they can express themselves in a way that they may not feel comfortable in other settings.
I love what you're doing with Tea Time. That's something we all should do in a group situation, even in a family situation. Tea Time would not be a bad idea to sit down and to be able to openly discuss things. I mentioned in the beginning, you're author, attorney, actor, director, musician. What are you going to do now? It doesn't sound like there's going to be a sequel to Ripple of Hope. What are you working on now?
I'm currently working on a film project. I had a short film called Zeke. It won a prize at the Prague International Independent Film Festival.
Congratulations.
Thank you. And I'm turning it into a larger project, hopefully in the next couple of years. Again, I have my professional career, so I do a lot of my creative stuff after hours, whether it's playing guitar or writing. But I found it's a good, this creative side of me, it's a good way to decompress from the other stresses or issues that we're dealing with on a day-to-day basis, whether it's doing laundry or doing your grocery shopping or dealing with high-level business issues. I find it very comforting for myself to kind of be able to take a step back, tune out from the world around me just for a little while, and to be able to write creatively play music with a few of my friends. We have a band, by the way. It's called Sage Honey Brandy. You can look us up on Instagram. And we try to, I try to, you know, incorporate those types of things into my daily walk, if you will, so that when I do come to stressful situations, I have enough built up within me that I can calmly deal with the issues. And people have called me calmer than they would expect, given the circumstances. And I try to make it look easy, but, you know, it's not always easy. And I just want to make sure people understand that, you know, all of this stuff comes with, you know, it doesn't come for free. There's a cost to it. You know, if you're growing a garden, your hands are going to get dirty. So, you know, hopefully these roses and tulips look beautiful enough, but, you know, understand that there is a lot of dirt underneath that needs to be, you know, worked out, and, you know, pulling out rocks and weeds. And it's not always easy, and it's not always, you know, gratifying, but it's certainly necessary.
That's another good lesson that Daryl is teaching us, to have that balance there, rather than go home and go through everything bad that happened during the day and you just build up until you're ready to burst. You've got something else and you can release that and go enjoy life. And you've got that balance and go in the next day and start all over again. Time has gone by so quickly here in the program. Daryl Nathaniel Bridgers, our guest. His book is Ripple of Hope, From the Boiling Frog's Perspective. Interesting website, the book, other things you'll find there as well. His website, his name, Daryl Nathaniel Bridgers, BRIDGERS.com. Like on our website, thisweekinamerica.us. That will take you directly there. His book available wherever books are sold. Daryl, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for being with us on the program.
Thank you so much, Rick. I really appreciate the time and the opportunity.
It's been a pleasure to have you with us, and I'd like to thank King Pages Press, the author's marketing consultant, results-oriented, making sure your work gets the attention it truly deserves. Our guest once again, Daryl Nathaniel Bridgers. His website is DarylNathanielBridgers.com. Link on our website. You're listening to This Week in America, and we're back on today's program right after these messages.
You're listening to This Week in America with Rick Bratton. More after this.